Okay, this is Sock Doc.
Hello.
Hello, Sock Doc.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Excellent.
Thanks for staying up so late.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Faith just said you're welcome.
I just heard that, yeah.
You should see her. In fact, I'm going to take
send her a picture.
I'm going to take a picture of her. She's wearing this.
Why is she in a singlet?
Somewhere underneath there.
She's wearing this full length North Face down jacket with a hood.
Holy,
it's like 42 degrees, and she's dressed like she's going to the Antarctic.
My car said 55.
Well, you know, tri geeks have thin blood. They don't like cold water, so they usually dress warm. You're lucky she doesn't have her wetsuit on. Faith, are you engaged?
I am, yep.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I thought you meant engaged into the podcast, because... Sometimes we worry whether her attention gets drawn off in different directions.
Faith is my little Facebook friend.
Yeah, Facebook buddies.
Is Mark on the phone yet or not yet?
He's coming up. I'm trying to dial him up. We dialed you first.
I thought you were wearing a parka. I am wearing a parka.
And let's see what happens. You're still there, right,
Steve?
I'm here, yep.
And we hear a ring.
Yes, Mark
Cucuzella, Don Freeman here.
Hey, Don.
How are you?
Good.
Sock Doc there?
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, I'll be good with... hey, Steve, how are you?
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, you too.
Are we recording?
And it was a miserable, miserable day for me.
Faith, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
4.
3, 4, 5, 6. Check.
You know, Dr. Mark Cucuzella, who's the guy that you've got to have on tonight.
All right, I will start this one.
All right, Faith, which step up?
Yeah, well, you asked me to step up. Okay, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Faith Goss.
I'm Don Freeman.
And I am Scott War, and it is the beginning of a new year.
That it is.
And what do we do at the beginning of a new year?
We make resolutions.
And we also look back on the previous year.
That's right.
And we decided it would be fun if we got Dr. Cucuzella and Dr. Gan Jimmy, the Sock Doc, to come on and do a round robin here at Trail Runner Nation and talk about...
Resolutions? No.
No, resolutions.
Oh, what are we talking about?
What did we learn in 2012?
Yeah, what did we learn in 2012? And I imagine, Scott, our entire budget for the year for guests is shot tonight because we're bringing two of our top guys on. We've got the Sock Doc and Dr. Cucuzella. We're not going to have any money left.
I didn't get my check yet.
You didn't get your check?
I didn't get that check yet.
It's in the mail.
Oh, there's that. We pay in Coca-Pellis here. You guys must have a Coca-Pelli.
You got that nice free shirt. That was pretty sweet. Yeah, still been wearing it.
Yeah, we trade in swag here. That's how we pay our bills. So, Scott, get this thing kicked off.
I think we should let ladies go first.
Yeah, Faith, why don't you start, and we'll make comments.
What did you learn this year, Faith?
We'll validate it, or we'll throw it out.
Give us one.
I had a big year. I front-loaded heavy in the beginning of the season, and then I kind of tapered off towards the end. But nonetheless, I learned a couple things. First of all would be, it's very hard to balance weightlifting and trail running.
Ooh.
Yeah.
More specifically, CrossFit. And we've thrown that one around a few times, I think, with both of the docs. It's pretty hard. I realized as much as I want to do it, it's too hard to cross-train in the form of heavy weightlifting for me.
Do you mean in form of time? There's not enough time?
Nope.
Or it doesn't...
Well, there's not enough time. That's true.
Recovery time, or
yeah, it's not good for my legs, and it was like a first part of the problem is admitting you have a problem. Second part is realizing.
Faith, wrong podcast.
Oh,
wrong meeting.
Yeah, wrong meeting. Okay, wait, scratch that. No, but it was too hard for me to keep my CrossFit family and my running family together, and I had to give up because my legs just couldn't handle it.
You gave up what?
I gave up CrossFit this year.
Oh.
Yeah. I dabbled a few times. I tried it. Then I stopped and I tried it again, and it's just, I gave it up.
I'd be interested to what the sock doc thinks of that.
Well, yeah, you know, like I said, we've talked about that. You know, it really depends on how well you want to be in your sport. So if you want to excel as a trail runner, you only can do so much strength, obviously more at different times of the year. But if you're preparing for a race, or especially a long one like you guys do, a 50K, 50-mile or 100-miler, your weightlifting is definitely going to taper off for many reasons. One is the time that you have still available to do it, the energy that you have to do it. And also, you know, the more you lift to a certain extent, you know, the slower, I don't like to say that, I guess I shouldn't say the slower you will become, but the less effort and energy and you know, your development will be going towards running. So, you know, you only get so far. And if you're looking just to be a great runner and a great strength athlete and sort of an all-around athlete, then you can balance those 50-50. But as you want to improve on one, then you have to sacrifice the other to a certain extent.
I like that perspective. We pick an A race, and then we build our other races around it and try to peak for that one A race. Maybe we pick our A sport and let the other one supplement it and not try to go all A in every sport that we're participating in, because it sounds like it's impossible.
I actually had a similar experience, because you guys know I talk about MoveNet. I'm big into MoveNet, which is natural movement in real-life situations. And I got big into that in this past year. And, you know, I still love it, and I've done a lot more lifting in the past, you know, 12 to 15, 16 months than I ever have. And I don't want to say my running has gotten slower. I have still been doing really well in a few races that I've done recently. But I do notice that you know, as I've gotten stronger and I can do more pull-ups, I can do more, you know, kettlebell workouts and this sort of stuff, and just stronger in general, that, you know, there are times where I'm out on a long run, I just don't have some of the spring and the step that I used to have now that I've gotten stronger in certain aspects. So I've kind of, you know, started to taper that down. And, you know, when I get closer to a race, you have to sort of, you know, pick your poison there in a way.
Dr. Cucuzella, do you have some thoughts on that, or are you ready to submit your...
tag on. I mean, it really is just what your goal is. You know, I mean, Ken Cooper, you know, outlined that it, you know, specificity is important, and what's your specific goal. You know, I remember being in college and we had Kenyans on my team and they never went to the weight room, you know, for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, and for some reason the rest of us Westerners would kind of get morphed into the weight programs, you know, that all the athletes were doing, but the Kenyan folks were kind of protected from that, because the philosophy was, well, they didn't train with weights, and no kidding, one of them went on to win the Olympic gold medal, and to this day, Kenyans never train with weights. Arthur Lydiard's runners never trained with weights, but they were very specific. These people were, you know, trying to win world championships in running. You know, my goal kind of, you know, like the sock docs right now, is just to be well and healthy, you know, so I don't do specific weight work, but I do a lot of plyos and bounding and skips and hops, and I don't think I'm getting any faster running, but I think I'm staying healthier, and it's fun, and I'm fresher every day, feel more balanced. So, you know, I feel good, and that's really what's important. So that's my specific goal. You know, so I think combining really heavy weight work with true endurance running, like ultra running, they are really opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, there's specific stability, you know, like the movement stuff that Steve does, that helps keep people injury-free, but, you know, maxing your power lifting is probably not going to make you better at a 50-mile trail run.
How about strength training, and I open this up to whomever would like to answer it, some strength training for climbing those hills, the real tough climbs, do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's when you can, you know, I mean, you can push or pull something, you know. Friends of mine have put some rocks and some cement cinder blocks and wheelbarrows and push those up, you know, hills before. It's great weightlifting type activity that helps power and development of your legs and your overall core. I mean, you can, you know, you can just run up a steep hill hard. I mean, you can do deep squats. You can do, you know, vertical and horizontal jumps to build up strength in your legs, even just via your body weight. So, I mean, you know, I think people's misconception about strength is that it has to include some sort of weight. you know, especially like a free weight. It doesn't necessarily have to do that. I mean, you can definitely use your body weight to a certain extent. And, you know, we know now, and a lot of people have been talking about it over the recent year or so, is that you can get a lot through your body weight, and especially through like an eccentric type movement. So even if you can't do, say, a pull-up because you're just not strong enough yet, someone can usually hang and lower themselves very slowly and develop strength that way. The same with a push-up. You know, you might be able to rack out, say, 30 push-ups, and it might not be that much of a workout for you, but if you do those, say, each push-up within 5 seconds down, 5 seconds up, and you're doing a slow push-up over 10 seconds, see how many you can do now, and you can get a much better body weight workout through that. Hmm. The one other thing I quickly wanted to mention is that's called, a lot of people talk about the SAID principle, specific adaptation to an imposed demand, SAID. And that's really what Mark is talking about, and we're all talking about, is that, you know, you're trying, and the Kenyans specifically, you're trying to be the best that you want to be in one event, in one sport, and you're really adapting your body to that type of activity. And therefore, the more you want to be specific in that event, the more you're going to take away from the others.
I think, you know, to touch on that, I think what Steve's saying is important, because everything goes back to history. So you look at, you know, how Arthur Lydiard runners, how they trained, and this was their pyramid. So they all did their endurance base, but then they all did 4 to 6 weeks of specific strength work, and that was hill work, and it wasn't in the gym. So they did that before they hit the track because they knew they needed to do that strength work or else they would break. You know, they would get hurt doing interval workout, and what that entailed was, you know, some more mellow mountain runs, but they did a lot of what are called hill springs and bounding, and these weren't really long duration or really anaerobic workouts. They were kind of, you know, plyos. They were body weight power runs for 60 to 80 meters springing up a hill. So it was that strength training, but it was very specific to work in the fascia, work in the movement patterns, work in the spring, but got them strong, and then they could go do intervals on the track. So he did a lot of stuff by trial and error, and he found that, you know, he didn't know all the exercise principles of why it worked, but he knew it worked. And I do a lot of that. I just think it's fun. I got a big hill right in front of my house. You know, it's not an anaerobic thing. I'll about 3 times a week. It's about 60 meters. I'll go up and down it 8 times, you know, and just open up my stride, you know, not to build up lactic acid, but just to get a little bit stronger. And it's fun. You know, you're not like barfing at the top. It's just 60 meters. and then, yeah, it's great.
You know, I think as trail runners, we get into that, get to the trailhead, and we kind of slog our course and get back to the end, and we just repeat it over and over. I'm just speaking for myself, and I want to throw everybody under this bus that I'm talking about. But I, you know, talking to Dr. Kukuzela last time, we committed, Scott, on doing some drills.
We did, and we haven't done it, have we?
Well, I've been doing them secretly.
Oh, have you?
No.
Liar.
No, but we got to get on it.
You know what? We need to do
that. We
got to
get on it.
We're recommitted. It's the new year. That's a new year's resolution.
That's the resolution. Okay. Who's got the next what I learned in 2012?
I think we need one of the doctors.
All right.
You're up there, Mark. Do you want to go ahead, Steve?
No, it's you. I just passed it to you. No gives you back seats.
I'll go to something not even involved with running. So I spent 6 months working on this Air Force project, which was the goal of it was to help people succeed in their fitness tests. And a big part of the fitness test and passing an Air Force, physical fitness requirement where you lose your job if you don't pass is there's a body mass component too, which is a waist circumference. So ignoring nutrition and focusing let's just teach people how to run better was kind of missing by half of what the problem was. So I kind of dug deep into the basic science of nutrition. And, you know, as a doc kind of taught in conventional wisdom, I thought I knew a little bit about it. You know, I was kind of your standard, you know, okay, I burn a lot of calories, I can eat a lot of calories, and, you know, I guess that's what people just need to do is just burn a lot of calories and, you know, and it'll all work out. But I didn't understand, you know, the basic science of fats and proteins and carbohydrates and glucose responses and insulin responses and leptin responses and blah, 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 and all that. But it was fascinating when I started to read about that. You know, and Tim Noakes is probably the preeminent sports scientist. You know, he wrote the Lore of Running, which is, you know, a Bible, you know, fourth edition, and he's kind of challenged every belief out there. So I started to read some of what he was writing about nutrition, and okay, maybe all this stuff about the carbs is not the truth. Maybe we actually need to fat adapt, not just for endurance performance, but, you know, just to be well people. You know, that a lot of this, high sugar intake and low fat intake, which, you know, the American Heart Association's been shoving down every doctor and nutritionist's throats for the last 30 years, maybe that's not all true. And, you know, and you can, you know, be your own learner, because, you know, I don't tell people what to do. I tell them to kind of read it and try things. So I started shifting a few things. Instead of my bowl of cereal every morning loaded with milk and bananas, you know, I started to have eggs and avocados and a lot more proteins, a lot more fats. Did not take sugars during training runs anymore. I'm like, well, gosh, I just need to teach my body how to utilize fat as fuel. Let me just not do that. And after a few weeks of not doing that, I actually felt empowered. I was like, gosh, I can go out on a two-hour run now, and I don't need to have a whole fuel belt full of gels, you know, loaded on me. I can figure it out. And yeah, and then my daily life is dealing with obese, sick people, not athletes. That's my job. And converting a lot of that nutrition knowledge into helping patients, I think, has made me a better doctor, because I've given people a much simpler plan. You know, I have been a real advocate my whole life of just, you know, if you have high sugar, don't take sugar. You know, don't have sodas and the white stuff. But now I understand a little more of why that's true, even for people that are endurance athletes. I think if we all learn a little bit more about nutrition, it'll just empower you to not be kind of controlled as much by food, but feel like you control a lot more. But, you know, a couple good reads out there are Gary Tobbs, Robert Lustig of UCSF just wrote a book I published about 2 weeks ago. It's called Fat Chance. It's on Amazon. Mark Sisson's book was just published today, a new book, Primal Living, that, again, goes into a lot of that epigenetics, too, we call it, where, you know, your DNA actually makes shifts based on the environment that it's exposed to, and that's movement and nutrition. But read those, you know, the Skinny on Obesity is another really good YouTube. If you just Google that, you'll see a 7-video series. It teaches about the basic science of nutrition, obesity. But that was kind of my new discovery, is actually taking the time to learn nutrition and apply it not just to athletes, but to patients and myself and even my family now. You know, I'm doing things a little different.
You know, I'll kind of dovetail. One of the things that I learned this year is very similar to that, and that was a podcast that we did, I don't know, maybe 5-6 months ago, called Metabolic Efficiency Training, which is based on a book that Bob Sibahar wrote. And we talked to one of his proteges, Tim Fleming, and also our nutritionist that comes on our program quite frequently, Sonny Blende, who actually implemented the strategies in metabolic efficiency training into her training schedule. And it was eye-opening to me. And I actually, in preparation for a race, started to do it. I didn't do it as well as I thought I should, but I did see success. Like you, Dr. Cucuzella, I got to the point where I would go out on, you know, a 2-3 hour run without any gels, just with, you know, water and maybe some a little bit of electrolyte drink, and I was fine. My body learned to burn the fat as fuel. And in fact, we just went on a run not too long ago, Don and I, where we were out for like 5 hours, and I think we both commented that we only had like 1 or 2 gels apiece the entire 5 hours we were out there. And so that was one of the things that I learned this year that kind of dovetails on what you said.
On the way to learning that, did you go through some serious dark bonks or what?
You know, I'm trying to remember.
Because I remember when you were doing this and I ran past you one time.
Yes, that's right. You're right. And
she doesn't let you forget. Yeah, Scott.
That's right.
This is not about the speed at all. It's
about, you need to slow it down quite a bit.
The adaptation. You're just making an adaptation. That's all training is what are you trying to teach your body to do for that specific run, you know?
Guys, one thing I want everybody to be aware of, Scott was going the opposite direction as Faith. She didn't pass.
She could have caught
behind.
Up,
yeah.
She could have caught up. That's right. I forgot all about that, but it was it was like a 3-3.5 hour run, and you're right, I did bonk. It was a hot day too, as I recall. But Yeah, I was training zero calories for a while, just you know, nothing before a morning run and just water. And a couple times it was not pretty. But I think it works. I'm recommitted to try it again this year.
I think most of the bad stuff that happens to us when we melt down and we go through a bonk, or the legendary stories we tell on the trail, that this race will always be known for this particular suffering that I went through. So much of it comes from, I would say, not under training, but not understanding our nutrition or our electrolytes or keeping the hydration in balance. I would think that's probably our biggest downfall or hurdle that we have to get over. So I think with your comments, Scott, I need to commit myself and Dr. Cucuzzella to understanding and learning more about what I'm putting in so I can keep going down the road without running into that dark spot.
You know, I will tell you one thing that my wife has gotten into lately is just the whole idea of eating whole foods. And I know you, especially yeah. Steve, you talk about this quite a bit, just eating non-processed, simple whole foods. And we just recently started that, and I'm actually kind of excited about it.
That's
except
good.
For my except for my Diet Coke that I had to give up.
You're not doing that anymore.
We just posted the top post on the Natural Running Center. I wrote a really short nutrition piece with some links to those books and a couple videos I just mentioned. So if any of the audience wants to check that out, it's on our website under Dr. Mark's desk. So those websites and books are on there if people want to dig into that a little more. Michael Pollan's book is on there too, an article by Dan Lieberman about the evolution of why we crave certain things, just some kind of fun stuff, you know, for the audience.
Yeah, I'll link that.
Good. Well, Dr. Cook is Dr. Gan Jimmy, are you next or am I going to throw one in? What would you like?
I was thinking of mine as you were talking. I'm gonna give you a short one.
All right.
So it's what I learned or what I plan to do?
Learned.
Okay. It's kind of the same thing, I guess. I learned.
You learn something, you refuse to do it. There you go. That's me.
I learned computers are evil things. And blogging more this year and writing more on the Sock Doc site, which has become increasingly popular, which I'm proud of.
Yeah.
And I spend more time every day and every week on this website and answering people's questions and running my other website and my own patient practice and that sort of stuff. I see what a lot of people deal with every day at their typical 9-to-5 job of sitting in front of a computer, and I can't imagine how someone can do that for 8 hours when if I sit in front of my computer for 2 hours, it drives me absolutely insane and I feel like shit the next day. So that's what I have learned this year, being in front of the computer more, and my resolution for 2013 is not to blow off a run or a workout or something because I have to get stuff done on the computer.
You need to hire a secretary.
Yeah, Sock Doc secretary. I don't know.
That way you can, on your run, dictate it into a recorder.
Hey, Sock Doc, do any of your employees that you have that help you at your practice, do they wear shoes, or are you a shoeless practice? Do you have to leave your shoe at the door when you're a patient?
My patients don't wear shoes. Most of my patients will take their – well, they always take their shoes off as I'm treating them.
Uh-huh.
Most of them, you know – They don't, you know, they're kind of barefoot type people anyway, or they know minimalistic. My secretary wears minimalistic running shoes. The other guy in my office, he's not quite into it yet, but
he will be
eventually, you know.
Hey Steve, I've got to share with you. I run with a member of Trail Runner Nation out in Utah when we go there for Christmas, and his name is Jeremy Haddock. And he gave me permission to tell this story and drop his name. So there it is, Jeremy. We make a tradition of going out and doing a run each time we go out there as a family to visit. Now, he said he's been listening to the podcast, and he was telling me about his work environment and that he's not wearing shoes. And right now there are 9 people within his office cubicle, you know, region that are not wearing shoes. Not full-time, but most all the time they are shoeless walking around, and he was the one that started it as a result of the podcast. So
awesome.
Who knows how many people are out there walking around America without shoes?
That's right. That's great. I know, Mark, you would be without shoes, but that's not allowed in the hospital, and you might not want to drop
that.
That would be
you might
gross.
Not want to drop it away with some needle on
shoes.
You.
We have nurses and Five Fingers and Ultras and
what?
Minimus. If you walk around our hospital, it's kind of an anomaly. They're all in these flat shoes, and you know the doctors.
I see two nurses who work at Duke, and they wear Vivo barefoots.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they're catching the bug because they're like looking around and saying. That person's looking pretty happy. What's on your feet?
It's directly related to what's on your feet.
And especially when they're on a 12-hour shift.
Like, not like Lance, you know. They're not on that stuff. They're on something else.
Well, speaking of shoes, this is what I've learned. And Sock
you learned
Doc,
about shoes?
Sock Doc, I think you'll have a field day with this one. So,
is it about Hokas? Are we going to talk about Hokas?
We are talking about the Hoka.
Are you?
You know, a Hoka is kind of like, we always need to at least mention Hoka once, even if we do 50 podcasts over our time.
You got it.
It has to be one of those, you know? It's like milk and cookies. It has to be mentioned.
All right. So from this point forward, and we've been pretty consistent with it, every podcast will mention Faith's Friend and a Hoka.
a Hoka reference.
Okay, Hoka reference. Now, here's what I learned. Now, we have all known that you don't do anything new on race day, right? I mean, that is embedded in everyone. In fact, my mom, who just ran her first 10K, told that to me. She says, I shouldn't wear this particular thing. I've never worn it during training. I can't wear it on race day. So we all know that. But here's what I learned. You can't do something new and just throw old away, put on a new pair of Hokas, and run in those exclusively without potentially experiencing a downside. And I think, you know, the knowledge that you provided, both of you guys, to me, that it's really not safe to make big changes, one, and then run on a large foam cushion and expect to have zero proprioception and not experience perhaps some knee pain.
You know what I love about this?
What?
Is you're so full of crap.
Why?
because you absolutely do that.
What?
How did you run Angeles Crest last year?
Well, no, this is what I learned. Yeah. I had worn them twice for two 10-mile runs and then put them on at mile 25. And
run 75 miles in Hokas.
Well, yeah. I had the option of taking them off any time, but then I kept them on. I mean, not I showered and I didn't shower in them, but I kept running in them and training in them. Yep. And I think that if you're going to make a change, either going flat or going up or going wherever you're going to go, you need to do it with some moderation. That you just can't start it and go 0 to 100. Even if you have a bunch of miles and endurance capacity and you make a change with your equipment, you've got to think about making some adaptation into that new gear. You just can't go 100% or you risk injury. And it took me about 3 months to get over this little issue, this bursitis in the front of my knee. Pes anserine is the area.
I think that's called Hokaitis.
is officially, we're going to label it?
Yeah, there's a diagnosis code for that.
You know, in all fairness, and you can call me on this too, Steve, I still love my Hokas.
There's a lot of people that do.
I do alternate between my Hokas, and I have a new pair of Salomon that I've really enjoyed this fall. But I still believe in the Hoka.
So, well, I would agree. I went to the running event in Austin, and you know, there's a seat for every butt, so they say. You know, and if it's a safe place for someone to go and they feel good, I mean, it's all about feeling good. It's in form. So there's a lot of folks who, you know, that's a comfortable ride, and you know, as long as they shorten their stride and have a nice turnover and a soft landing, whether it's barefoot or in a Hoka, you know, it's all good. I mean, they're out running and preventing diabetes, so it's yep. I think there's a real place for them in the market.
So my big lesson is slow, just adapt slow to whatever you're doing.
That was perfect segue for mine.
Well, that's why I did it.
Wow. So I think my next thing that I learned for 2013 or for 2012 would be kind of two things. So start slow, like start low and go slow kind of thing. Like just start with low mileage and enjoy that for a little bit. Don't up it too fast. And then the second thing would be that base training is really important. in that you know, we spend all this time building, like when we start low and go slow, you build that base and that can carry you, you know, through these longer races. And even after the races, when you're going through your recovery, keep your mileage up. But you are an endurance athlete and you still, you know, you have, once you've built that base, you don't really lose it. You may lose it a little bit physically, but you've got it mentally. And so I got really discouraged after I took time off from American River. After that race, I was like, oh, I probably just lost it. And I was really sad to lose all that mileage that I had built up, but you still have it. And I think you should give your time, you know, your body time to recover. You don't have to keep going a lot after a race. It will still be there. So the importance of building a solid base in racing, I think, is something that I learned this year.
That's a good lesson.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody?
It takes time. What do you guys think, doctors? What do you think about how long you could take 2 to 3 weeks off? Are you going to lose much fitness as a result of a couple weeks off? Or are you going to get stronger? What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think the science tells us you lose very little, you know, really in that 3 to 4 weeks, because a base is like a lifelong thing. So if any of us who've been moving for years and years and years took a month that we didn't run, but we just stayed active and, you know, played around with the kids or did whatever, you know, I've had months where I've been traveling and had very few runs, and it takes a week or two, but you don't miss that much. I mean, maybe if you're racing on the track or something, you know, really doing something high end, but no, I mean, I think, and look again at, you know, what the best runners in the world do. They actually take a month and go back to the farm, you know, and they actually do take a month completely off. And I think most of us just enjoy being outside too much that it's hard to do that. It's like, well, why? I'd like to go run. So, yeah, don't fear that. It's listen to your body, I think, is the bottom line. If you're just tired and beat up and you just finished a, you know, I used to take a decent amount of time off after the JFK 50 miler. I didn't do this year, that race this year, because I was too tired even to enter it, and I knew it would have been a bad decision. But I used to take pretty much the whole month off after that, because that beat me up pretty bad just to finish that thing. And I listened to my body, and then I sprung back pretty quick. So I think you just have to trust it. Everyone has this fear that they're going to, like, get out of shape, but, you know, get over it, gain a little weight over the holidays, and it comes right back off. And I think that's kind of money in the bank when you build your strength back again.
I know that Brad Kearns out here, a great endurance athlete, triathlete in the tri scene, he says after a long A race, it's time to take 2 weeks off and go around town and sample all the pie.
Yeah,
I like pie. I think it's also healthy from a mental standpoint too, to take a break and relax and do something different. Just from a mental sanity point of view, I know people that have their training calendar, and it's a regiment, and it's almost like a stick that's beating them. And if they don't do their run, even after these long races, they just don't take time off. And I don't think it's healthy mentally.
People are afraid to miss one day, yeah. And that's not good.
Oh yeah, you read about these guys doing streak running, you know, 2-3 years in a row. You know,
I like streaking.
Man, I figured that.
He just dated himself because Faith has no idea what a streaker. Do you know what a streaker is, Faith?
Well, what kind of streaker? I know a lot of streakers. What do you mean? Like a streaker, like you're running naked? Or?
Okay. Well, she's, you know what? Maybe
hold
she's
on.
That.
How do you know a lot? Who knows a lot of streakers? Like nobody. Good for you.
Good for you, Faith. Good for you.
Yeah.
Mark, I think it's your turn.
That's another thing in 2012. You know, I think I've been traveling around the Air Force teaching, you know, better running and how to pass the fitness test, and I think what I figured out that it's not too tough to learn this stuff. You know, people have made running form and, you know, whatever you'd call it, natural running, better running, barefoot running, you know, have made this complex thing, but it's really pretty simple. And people can learn it. Anyone can learn it. You know, when I teach it, I get people to simply increase their cadence, see what that feels like, just get them to feel the energy being different than that slow, sticky pattern, you know, get them to feel it in their own bodies, what using that elastic recoil is, and off they go, and they get it. So it's simple to teach and learn, and it's a good start point. Anyone with 10 minutes on their hands, 5 minutes, can reset their running pattern. You know, then it takes 30 to 60 days to wire it in, but,
you know, it doesn't take a 4-day course to learn how to run better. You know, find a good teacher and get them to show you how to do it and go do it again and again and again and don't fall back into the old patterns. You know, we're getting data back and, you know, surveys back and emails back that, you know, wow, that was pretty simple. It's helped me. I'm knocking time off my PT test. You know, we're setting up to do some real research on the methods, but, you know, right now, just anecdotally from doing all these classes, you know, it's easy to learn, and people don't go back to the other way. They can't say, well, that way, that new way doesn't feel good. I'm going to go back to the old way. I have not heard that yet. You know, everyone likes
it. And it's easier, too, isn't it?
Yeah. I think just identifying what they're doing wrong simply, because no one's ever shown them, and show them simply how to do it a little better. It's like a golf swing. You know, but in running, we don't see the slice, you know, because you just plod along. But, you know, fix it and you like, you feel it.
And on naturalrunningcenter.com, you have that great YouTube video that's 8 minutes and 24 seconds long. That's how I tell people about it, because I reference it anytime that someone wants to hear me talk about it. Because you break it down. You break down the form. And
that's been more complex than someone just, if I'm teaching it to somebody. Yeah. If you want to understand a little more about movement patterns and the muscle usage, that 8-minute video is good. But if I'm going to go teach someone, it's like 30 seconds. You can teach them the things. If they want to learn a little more about why, I think the video is a good complementary tool. You know, SocDoc site, Jay DeSherry's book. You know, there's a lot of resources out there that'll support people that really want to understand a little more about it. But a lot of people, they don't really care. They just want to run easier and better and less pain, and they don't care about fascia and muscles and all that stuff. They just want to run, and that's the audience we're trying to help in the Air Force.
Would you say that we have forgotten how to run? We knew it initially. I mean, as kids, do kids go out and have the proper form, and then we mess it up as we grow older and do different things, and we have to relearn it, or some people were just never taught? What's your opinion?
I mean, I think if you look at what's out there and look at the data and kids' movement patterns, as soon as you put a shoe on a kid, especially a cushioned shoe, they start to overstride even at age 3 and 4. So I think it's a little of both. You can't take the average, you know, 5 or 6-year-old who's in a big heeled shoe and you watch them run. They're very uncoordinated, a lot of them, and they're overstriding. You know, you take their shoe off and they kind of spring and pop along the ground in a much different way. So I think it all depends on which kids you're looking at. But as a parent, I think, you know, we need to kind of go back and not put our kids in these big bulky shoes that have big lights and are stiff. You know, let the kid's foot be a foot, and then, you know, they don't need to kind of relearn things that they shouldn't have unlearned to begin with.
Have you watched some of the Kenyan culture, some of the people that never had shoes, and you see that they just have that great form from start to finish?
Yeah, and I just look at my own town, because, you know, we've given away, just out of my story, we give away every year about 200 to 300 pair of Viva Barefoot kids' shoes. And, you know, the kids walk around town and they're, you know, they're called like Dr. Mark shoes. But the parents come up to you and say, gosh, I get it, you know, because they see their kids move different. You know, my own wife is a doc. She, you know, she's an infectious disease doc, you know, way smarter than I am. But she didn't understand, you know, foot and muscle movement. And, you know, my kids liked the light shoes until I, you know, started to get into the shoe thing. And then I put a pair of skinny shoes on my kids, you know, against better judgment of a dad when you try to intervene in your children's apparel, but my wife let me do it. and she was like, wow, they move different. And, you know, from that day forward, you know, my kids, they're like, they could work in my store. You know, they get it. And they're like, you know, 7 and 9.
Child labor laws, Mark.
Steve, your kids are in these shoes, if they have to wear shoes, but, you know,
yeah.
Right.
Well,
yeah, I mean, they're barefoot as much as possible.
Well, my first kid's pairs of Vivo Barefoots are from you, Dr. Mark. Thank you very much. And they've only been in those since. And, you know, my kids, you know, just to come off what he's saying there, I mean, he's absolutely right, especially if, you know, I have 3 kids. My kids are 9, 10, and 4, and my little one, so he's been out of shoes the longest, even though he's the youngest. I mean, I guess, you know, for, you know, really never being in shoes even from the beginning. And it's pretty amazing to watch him run. He can run from grass to pea gravel to sharp gravel to pavement without changing his stride or without flinching or without going, ah.
Wow.
It's unbelievable, you know?
You need to take a video of that. You need to get your video camera out and take a video of that and let us
post
you're
right. But I mean, I can't do that. I mean, you know, you're still kind of walking on eggshells over some of these sharp rocks. But I mean, he might go out sometime and look at his foot to see if it's cut. But I mean, it's unbelievable because he never learned not to, you know, how do you say it? He never learned the wrong way to run. He never learned the wrong way to move. So I mean. And you guys know he has cowboy boots, which he wears now and then because they're super cool.
Yeah,
it's cool. But you know, for the most part, I mean, he's in his little Vivo barefoot Rudies, or he's in a pair of flat, you know, snow boots, or he's really just barefoot like all the time. And it's like, and the bottom of his feet are still super soft, but I mean, it's unbelievable what the kid can do. You know, and he's pretty much been running and walking barefoot outside as long as I have, you know, 2.5 years or so. So, you know, I mean, basically it comes down to you can lose it very quickly, especially, or as a kid, you might never develop it and you never learned it. I'd say that's true for most kids. I mean, I see a big part of my practice is kids, I'd say the average age between, you know, 6 and 12, 13. And I see kids with, you know, they're super uncoordinated, they're super awkward, their Achilles are already bowing in, like with pronation problems, foot weakness problems, and it's because of how they've been brought up. And unfortunately, even though you can strengthen a lot of these things and get them out of shoes, those cosmetic defects that they have developed, like fallen arches and even the start of toe issues like bunions and that sort of things, you know, you can't, you know, you can help to alter those a little bit, but for a lot of them, they've already developed lifelong deformities of their feet, you know, that can't be corrected. Even at age 12, 13, it's kind of sad. Would you agree, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I see kids in high school now with hallux valgus, and for the audience out there, that's like when your big toe's bent inwards, you know, pointed shape like a shoe, and it's really, really difficult to run properly and stabilize your kinetic chain and your foot with that toe already messed up. So those are the more downstream permanent effects. You know, kids are naturally uncoordinated as they learn to run, and that's normal. That's a kid learning how to run. You know, but they have to feel the ground. That's how gait training occurs is from that neuromuscular connection. You know, that's how we retrain stroke patients, is they have to rewire and relearn and feel the ground. So what we're applying now to stroke patients is not new. It just goes back to the same things that, you know, it's not barefoot technology. There is no technology. It's human technology, but you know, it's all the same stuff.
One thing I wanted to quickly mention before we get too far away from talking about form is something that I learned in the late part of 2012.
Wait, you've already had your two.
Yeah.
I have something else to say.
You can have mine, Faith.
The space friend.
This is my friend. Yeah, she gets an extra one. I learned to use something called the Galloway method. And I use it on the road, and I train on the road during the week, and it's really helped me concentrate on my form. And that what it is I will run for 5 minutes and walk for 30 seconds, run for 5 minutes and walk for 30 seconds. And it's been really useful in, you know, helping me kind of check in and, okay, how's my form doing, concentrating on, you know, more of a 4-foot strike and just thinking about my body position in relation to my feet. And I think it's been really helpful because it's helped me work on my form a lot and made me focus on that.
That's good. You know, I had one quick follow-up question. You're talking about shoes for kids and, I mean, you know, these minimalist shoes. I mean, for people that are listening to this podcast and they have kids and even I thought as you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, I have a pair of work boots that I go to work in every once in a while because I get out in the fields and work with some farmers. Where do I get a pair of work boots that are minimalist? They don't make them,
Vivo
do they?
Vivo Barefoot makes work. Yeah, they make hiking boots like that. Now,
Innovate,
I don't think, Mark, there's not a steel-toe boot, is there?
Which is, it's not a steel-toe, so probably depends on what what type of upper you want. But the Innovate makes a Gore-Tex boot. It's called the 288, and got like a, I think, 4 to 6 millimeter heel. Belleville's coming out with a military boot called the Mini Mill, which is going to have, it's out in some prototypes now, 4 millimeter heel, but you could wear that as a outdoors person with not being in the military, you know, pick your color. It's a decent boot. And Vivo Barefoot makes a leather boot that's kind of like a leather hiker, but it could be like a farm and work boot. You could waterproof up the leather. Really nice boot.
Now, you have a lot of these on your website for your store, yeah. Mark. Give us your website so people can go there as they're listening to this and kind of cruise through there.
We don't have those specific boots in our store, but you can probably get them through the companies themselves. We have the Innovate 288. The other two we do not have at the store, but they're good options. Look around. And before the minimalist stuff hit, I used to take my military boot and cut the heel off it, and no one really knew it. So you can take a boot and take a little hacksaw to it and have some fun and make a minimalist boot out of your other boot. It's pretty easy to do.
Mark, what's your website to your store?
tworiverstreads.com.
Great.
How are we doing on time?
I've got a few more minutes, okay. Then we'll be on the hour.
Good, good. Let's.
Whose turn was it?
I'm committed to remember next year whose turn it was. That's what I'm.
Let's say Mark.
All right.
So Mark just went.
Oh, did he?
I've done two.
How about you?
So we'll pass the torch. I have one more.
Okay, go ahead.
If we're doing two each, it's my turn, I believe. I'm going to go with don't believe all the media hype and do your research. Don't change your training based off the latest research blurb, training paradigm, quick fix pill that came out that Dr. Oz or somebody talked about. Basically, don't follow the hype that's out there in our crazy media world and adjust your training that was probably going so well and try and chase another different type of training regimen just because of some new, headline news report.
That's a good one.
I think that's good for people to realize, because with Facebook out there and everything, I mean, people literally want, they don't think about what they're doing and how it's hopefully working for them, and they just want to, try to improve faster or maybe fix an injury quicker and go to a new drug that might not be researched properly or a new method and only end up screwing themselves up more because of some bad science. So do your homework and wait for things to settle in.
You really have to consider what the source is. The internet is, in all of its good, has so many resources out there that may not be quite valid and vetted and have been reviewed by others and approved. Anybody, heck, we made a website.
And not only that, most research, and I know this from very good patients / friends who are researchers at well-known universities. I mean, they say most, or 50% of research is just flat-out wrong. And then there's even more that is altered to give desirable results that are allowed to be published. And we never see results of research that was not desirable to who is funding the research. So if you get 10 studies on a certain shoe product, and one of them is good, that's the one that's going to be published. You're not going to see the 9 that weren't published because it wasn't favorable to the person funding the research. So, there's lots of stuff out there that we never even see, and there's even more, or maybe as much, as that is misinterpreted and, left sort of up for grabs on how to interpret it themselves, or the graphs and that sort of stuff are sort of misinterpreted to give it more desirable results. So, it's kind of crazy out there. It's kind of, tough to trust what you believe in. And I think you always just got to go back to the basics and see what's working for you, what's been working for a long time. And that's it.
That reminded me back in college, I took a statistics class. And the one thing I remember coming out of the statistics class is don't believe everything that you read, because they'll skew it to make it look like what they want to prove.
They have to, yeah. They have to.
No
scientist is going to be complete to get grants and be hired again and again and get funding by publishing undesirable results. That's a fact.
Wow.
Right, Mark?
Exactly. I mean, if you even look at the antidepressants, there was a large New England Journal article about 2 years ago that when you included all the negative trials, meaning the unpublished trials that didn't show a favorable benefit, there was, across the board, no benefit in the standard antidepressants you see advertised. That doesn't mean that we should
should never use them as clinicians. You know, we use our judgment of who's the right candidate, but if you look at the data, you know, these are not, you know, across the board magic fix. You know, as many people have no effect or worse as get better. You know, it's a wash. So be skeptic. Yeah. Again, be your own, you know, be your own advocate. Get the knowledge yourself.
I've seen patients, you know, since I'm smack dab in the middle of Duke and UNC, every year I'll see a patient or two who has been in a certain study at one of these very prestigious universities, and they've been kicked out of the study because they are not, following. I mean, I should say they're following what they should be doing for the study, but they're not fitting into the study group. In other words, they might be performing better or worse, and they're actually kicked out because they're not having the desirable effects of the drug therapy or the cognitive therapy or whatever they're doing, so they're out.
Pay attention to who your funders are.
Yeah. So this is just a real simple example because we're all see advertisements. So you take a medicine that's highly advertised like Chantix, and everyone thinks this is, quote, the smoking cessation pill. If you looked at the study of how that got approved, they basically threw out anyone who was a hardcore smoker, anyone who had ever tried a smoking cessation product before, who had any lung disease, any chronic disease, any mental health illness, anything at all was basically excluded. They wouldn't let them in the study. So basically they chose very minor league smokers. And even them, they had very little effect versus doing nothing. But, you know, if you were going to fund the study, you want it to succeed because you're going to sell the product. So just anything, it's like food. One of Michael Pollan's food rules are, if you see it advertised on television, do not eat it, period. So if you see a drug advertised on television, don't buy it. You know, I think, yeah, just put that advertising piece, don't watch television is probably the best advice, and then you won't even know what's being advertised, and you'll go, like Steve says, go buy an orange. You know, there's no label on it. It's an orange. It doesn't say low fat.
They are gluten-free, though. I'm told that every time I go buy an orange now.
Really? They have the label in that.
I love that. Gluten-free
orange.
Orange
pizza.
Thank you.
You know, I'm putting oranges on my pizza now. You know? Something new for 2013, and the orange and the eggplant.
You know, I'm going to take it back to what I learned in 2012 and kind of redirect us in that area. And one of the things I learned is, I have so much to learn. I ran the same race that I've run. I end up cramping at mile 15. It was the 100-mile run, and I'm working through it. But it took me 30, 40 miles to work through these ridiculous cramps. What is going on? I've learned that you never get this stuff figured out completely. There's always something changes. There's some curveball that's going to come at you that no matter how many times you do it or what you prepare for, you're going to get hit with something you're not expecting. So one, I maybe already knew that, but now I accept it. I accept it. There could be just some chaos that happens on race day, and you just have to deal with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I that's like someone who, you know, they ate their pre-race breakfast or pre-race meal, and they had an awesome race, and then they try it again, and they do terrible, right? You know, and it's like you're always trying to figure out the exact thing to eat, the exact time, you know, the exact time to take a nutrient, you know, a salt tablet or a gel pack or something like that. And it's never the same because we're dynamically changing human beings, you know?
So many variables.
Have you seen the latest commercial on TV about superstitions? I think it's a Bud Light commercial where they're lining up the Bud Lights or turning the labels towards the goal or something like that. And they said, it's not stupid until it doesn't work.
For being superstitious. Yeah. So I think that's just it. You're right. We're dynamic, and there are so many variables that we can't even keep. We couldn't even list all the variables. Okay. We're probably scratching the surface of the variables, you know.
Danya, I think a good takeaway for 2013 is, like, you know, if you go, this is quoted by the race director of Leadville, it's like, you know, if you started out on an adventure and you were positively sure you were going to succeed, why bother starting? I think Hillary said that. So, I mean, that's kind of why we're here. I mean, if we were nickeling and diming all the science till this was some sure thing, why in the hell would you go out and do a 50-mile trail race? What kind of fun is that? You know? Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's no fun. You know, you're going to throw shit to the wind a little bit and try something new, and if it doesn't work out, you know, that's, you're out there trying. I'll try some new things there down in South Africa and see if I can finish that race. You know, but there'll be some challenges, some bad spots, but it'll be a new thing. We'll give it a go.
Yeah, working through it's half the fun.
You know, I was going to – my second thing that I learned in 2012 kind of, again, is related to that, and that is running a 50K or a 50-mile or 100-mile race is freaking hard.
Yes, it can be, yeah.
That's what I learned. You know, I learned it the hard way where, you know, I had run some 50-milers. I've run a bunch of 50Ks. I've run a 100-miler. And this year I took a break and didn't run a whole lot of races. And I had a race that I needed to run to qualify for Western States. And I went into it thinking it's just 50 miles. And guess what? It was hard.
You got your...
I got my act handed to me. handed to me. And that's what I learned is you cannot take any of those distances, even, you know, a 10K, I'm sure. You can't take those for granted. You have to have respect for the trail and respect for the distance. That's what I learned.
Yeah, that's a good one. Because the trail will humble you.
Yes, it will.
Wait, do we leave anything on the table? Did anybody have a burning one that they want to make sure is submitted for discussion before we wrap this?
Before we close out 2012?
Before we officially close out 2012.
So many good things ahead in 2013. Let's close it out. There's so many good things
Faith
ahead.
Wants to go to dinner.
No, I want to go to bed. I don't do dinner this late. No,
it's 11:15. It's only 9. What is it, 8:15 there? We're the ones up late.
I go to bed at 8:30.
You do, really?
Secrets out of the bag.
Wow, you have no life.
Guys, she's soft, let me
I'm
tell
a
you.
Loser.
No wonder you don't have time to cross train.
She has her driver out in front waiting for her.
Right.
Well, guys, thanks so much for coming on. Sock Doc, not make me say your website address, okay?
Sock-doc.com.
Which will be linked at our website, sock-doc.
You need to learn in 2013 is how to say his website.
Go to Natural Running Center to find Dr. Mark Cucuzella and his wisdom, words from his desk, his video. He has a store at Two Rivers Thread.
You're fired.
I'm not. You know, somebody else could have picked this up and started talking. You guys just left it for me to mess up here.
It's because we like to hear you say it wrong.
We'll link that as well, and we'll make sure that works for you, Dr. Cucuzella. So we'd like to thank you guys for coming on and sharing
always
with their
lessons. Enjoy your words of wisdom.
And in 2013, we say, run mucho más.
Run mucho.
Mucho más.
I think we'll have an off-air discussion on mucho más.